Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is the final one of this, the sixth night, and I'm now here with Richard Wollstonecroft, and he agreed to do this at short notice, so thank you very much for that. And sorry also about the delay in the schedule, but we're here now.
That's so fine,
Richard, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience in your own words so that I...
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's generally better, yeah.
I'm an Australian filmmaker and I guess writer and independent like events promoter. You know, I run the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, which I can just show you a catalogue for. That was the 22nd Melbourne Underground Film Festival that finished about a week ago. You know, I've run 22 of those over the years. I've made about 6 or 7 independent features. One of the more famous ones, maybe in the circles who might watch this show, is a film called Pearls Before Swine, starring Boyd Rice and Douglas P. Boyd Rice is from the industrial band Non, and Douglas P is from the band Death in June, who many of you might know. You know, I've made a number of other films. My first film was a vampire film called Bloodlust. My most recent feature is one called The Debt Collector, which is a kind of revenge film. You know, I do a podcast thing, I guess similar to this kind of thing, but they're like little 5 or 10 minute takes of my views on things. It's, I guess it's politically orientated. It's called The Report from Tiger Mountain. It's hosted at a site called The Unshackled. And I'm on another show called The No Goat Show, which is a kind of show on Cafe Lockdown, which is a kind of freedom movement, anti-vaxxer thing. That's the T-shirt or the image of the show. So, you know, I guess I'm a bit of a cultural provocateur, cultural engineer. I'm somebody in the arts who has a kind of leaning to the new right. So that's a little bit unusual because most people in the film industry and the entertainment industry are obviously quite left-leaning. And that used to be kind of cool in the 90s. Everybody in the 90s kind of accepted that I was a bit right-wing-leaning, and I was welcome to all the dinner parties. They liked to debate me. But I noticed that began to change about 10 years ago. And around the time of Trump, people really began to uninvite you, you know what I mean? Because it seemed like the kind of politics that I was interested in was actually manifesting itself on the world stage in a kind of major way with Donald Trump, with Brexit, you know, people like Bolsonaro. And, you know, it was like, hang on a minute, this kind of what they thought was a marginalized politics to some extent was becoming more mainstream. And obviously, I've always been interested in that. I do have an interest in the populist right. And I think it's great when politics sort of, you know, even though people like Donald Trump and even Brexit, obviously they weren't perfect and they had many problems, et cetera, but they were still, you know, large scale manifestations of a certain kind of politics that I admired and had an interest in.
I think it's fascinating that you are in the arts world or the creative world, the media world, because a lot of people, sorry, I've got to have a cough sweet because otherwise I think I'm going to lose my voice.
Have your cough. Because
a lot of people would think that is just leftoid, like far left, completely liberal. One of us or someone associate, someone who had vaguely our ideas even, would have to be completely silent, be completely incognito in that world. Now, obviously, this changes with time. And in the 90s, I've said this myself, I can remember that the climate was very different in the 90s. It was still fashionable to have, and there was still an idea of fashionable leftist liberal ideas.
Of course.
But you wouldn't get crucified if you didn't hold them. Whereas it's a bit different now. And as you say, it changed about, well, this will differ from one country to the next, but definitely Brexit and Trump had something to do with it.
Yeah, well, there certainly are right-wing films and filmmakers, you know, I mean, that have been around the entertainment industry for a long time, really. I mean, back in the old days, I mean, obviously film noir itself, for example, the whole genre is practically right-wing, right? You know what I mean? And in the kind of world it depicts. I've always been interested in genre films because I think that's a genre, like particularly things like crime films, action films, thrillers and horror films. They're all particular genres that have strong connections to right-wing ideas. If you look at a film like Dirty Harry, that's quite a right-wing film. If you look at a film like Taxi Driver, that's quite a right-wing film, even though Paul Schrader, you know, who I sort of vaguely know, we awarded him one year. His film was The Canyons, played at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. I gave him Best Film and Best Director and everything. And, you know, he's quite right-wing, even though he protests that he's left-wing. I mean, maybe he legitimately is left-wing, is sort of critiquing right, you know, in the films he makes. But he made that film Mishima, which was like an ode to fascism, you know, the Japanese fascist author, you know, Yukio Mishima. So, you know, and, you know, I guess more recently, you know, there've been a lot of kind of interesting films, say a film like Fight Club, that has, you know, it was accused of having a kind of fascist cheek. You know, and there are a number of different filmmakers, you know, whose work, you know, I mean, David Lynch is somebody, you know, whose work has a certain kind of European kind of presence, you know what I mean? And David Cronenberg.
And just a general conservatism. I mean, David Lynch deconstructs American suburbia, but he doesn't do it in a malicious way. It's a very affectionate way. So it would be not, I don't think it would be fair at all to say that David Lynch is a subverter or something like that. Not at all. Clearly an affection for that norm.
He loves the 1950s, and he loves that whole aesthetic of the, you know, the strong-jawed kind of Gary Cooper, you know, and obviously Dale Cooper is a kind of representation of that in Twin Peaks. And even though he shows the kind of underworld, you know, you know, I mean, it's kind of interesting if you saw the new season of Twin Peaks, you know.
I haven't seen that yet. I know the first two seasons very well.
There's a second demon. You know, there's the original demon Bob, who's in season one and two. There's a second demon in season three called Judy or Judy. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, very interesting. And, you know, he portrays the kind of FBI, you know, Dale Cooper character is a great hero, even though he's sort of, you know, trapped in the Black Lodge a lot of the time. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of actual right-wing filmmakers. And obviously, through running the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, I meet many filmmakers from around the world, and many of them are. And as you say, most of them just stay quiet. I mean, obviously, someone like Clint Eastwood is a major, you know, right-wing filmmaker. You know, I mean, many directors in the old days, Don Siegel, for example, Sam Peckinpah. You know, I mean, even though Sam Peckinpah had a bit of a hippie vibe sometimes, or a bit of a free, you know, I guess libertarian kind of thing. You know, but obviously, I do have an interest in libertarianism to some extent, particularly, you know, during the whole pandemic thing. You know, which I was totally disagreed with all the lockdowns and all the hysteria. And the forced vaccination, the way they were, you know, doing mandates and forcing people to take this thing when, you know, I mean, it should have been something that should have been there as an option. If you wanted it, go take it. You know what I mean? And, you know, people could make their own decision about that. Obviously, I wouldn't have done it and didn't do it. But, you know, the way they were trying to force people into this thing was just very suspicious. So libertarianism became a kind of, you know, and obviously I was interested in that too with, you know, various other right-wing political leaders, you know, I've always been interested in that, but then I am interested in a kind of right-wing collectivism, I guess, as well. So, you know, so.
You mentioned David Cronenberg.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you mentioned him, because I do like David Cronenberg, and I absolutely love The Fly.
Me too, yeah.
And then that's one of my favourite films, actually. And then, yeah, I've seen Crash, the cinema back in the day, actually. What else? Videodrome, The Dead Zone, and then I did see Naked Lunch, but a very, very long time ago. More recently, I saw A History of Violence, and I think that's it. I think that's all the films by him that I've seen. So
there's a film called Videodrome that I recommend, which
I've seen that one. Yeah,
Videodrome. That one's kind of about a right wing sort of conspiracy theory kind of vibe, you know, and same with Scanners. Really, you know, he often writes about, you know, a nefarious kind of level of government that's up to no good and people rebelling against it. You know, often to do with things like, you know, telekinetic powers and things like this.
So I guess I'm just curious about why you would say he was right wing, but I can see what you're getting at. So
libertarian, you know, of these filmmakers. Obviously, I think someone like, you know, G.J. Ballard is a right-wing author, you know, even though, you know, I mean, there's a case that he writes kind of dystopian novels about, you know, the way that the world is collapsing in various ways, you know. I think he does that as a kind of, like, warning, you know what I mean? He's clearly warning people that the world can go in fucked up ways. And that, you know, if you look at the last 3 years, I mean, that's a classic example of the world entering a dystopian kind of nightmare. That's very G.J. Ballard. And, you know, I mean, he wrote novels that, you know, all along many different subjects. And his last series of novels that culminated in one called Kingdom Come is, you know, he was always talking about fascism a lot and about how there was a kind of the middle class sort of was embracing kind of fascist kind of values, and but not for any almost political reason, out of a kind of benevolent psychopathology, which was his idea of the human mind itself was sort of altering, and that psychopathology was becoming a major issue. You know, so he's very interesting. I love William Burroughs as well, who wrote The Naked Lunch. He's obviously somebody connected to, the Beat Movement, and, he was good friends with a left-winger like Allen Ginsberg. But, if you look at his work, he often talks about agents. I almost felt that William Burroughs was an agent, kind of exposing because if you think about what he wrote about in The Naked Lunch, he's writing about drugs, he's writing about human trafficking, he's writing about sexual depravity, he's writing about sort of like this group of globalist criminals. And in a sense, that's almost the original novel that exposes the whole, globalist nightmare, and it was called Interzone. So I see William Burroughs as actually a double agent who, hung out with the Beat Generation, but to expose the depravity and insanity that was beginning to take hold in the 1950s, and 60s, when the globalist agenda was really beginning to take hold globally.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can see that angle. I think with J.G. Ballard is a very interesting example of this, because I think he is categorically right-wing. I mean, I think he was, he basically, that was explicit.
Yeah.
I've read Concrete Island.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is Concrete Island. That is a really, I know that it was going to get adapted a few years ago. I don't think it ever actually happened, but it's a fascinating idea, because mm-hmm. Just for anyone who doesn't know, it's an architect, a young architect, early 30s or something, driving, I think on his way to work or on his way from work, and he becomes stranded in a traffic island between, I think it's three highways. This wasteland in the middle. So he's surrounded by these very, very busy roads. It's this sort of ditch. It's difficult to picture it, but... Yeah. There will be places like this in the world. There will be places where this could happen. And the gist of it is, he then has to escape from this zone in the middle, this nowhere land, no man's land in between these three highways. There are busy roads, cars are going past him all the time, and yet nobody helps him. And so he's stranded there, and sort of imprisoned there. Mm-hmm. And it goes on. With all the story is, it's a short, it's like a novella.
Yeah, a novella.
He goes on with his different attempts to escape, and then he starts seeing people, meeting people down in this ditch, and you're never sure whether it's real or not, whether these are real people or not. And then eventually it ends with him just saying, or the narrator declaring that he will keep attempting to escape. And he knows he will escape one day. And there's this awful sense that he's never going to escape. So it's a very interesting story.
It's like a Robinson Crusoe trapped on an island, but he moves it to a kind of, kind of a wasteland. And it's got a place, and this place has a kind of building in it. There's a kind of old cinema, decrepit cinema. So, he's got some food and he can grow food, and a woman goes there. So he's got a partner now. It's like he's starting to build a new society in this traffic island. You know what I mean? He did a similar story in High Rise, which was made into a film recently. I think it was Ben Wheatley who made it. And that's a very right-wing film in a way, because it has, it has the kind of class system. We're up on the top floors, it's the upper class. The executives live in the middle, and the poor people live at the bottom. And then some of the people on the lower middle class, become rebellious, and they begin to basically cause trouble in the... in the high rise, and then eventually everybody starts fighting everybody. And once things starts going wrong, the police don't come anymore. It's like it's just been left to its own kind of whatever you call it,
internal law,
and it all begins to collapse and everything. And you think that sounds nonsensical. If you look what happened during COVID, you look what's happening in China right now, where people are locked in their buildings, they're fighting. I mean, this is very much a kind of reality. That's why Ballard is so spot on, just great.
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. And I always want to absorb more of J.G. Ballard's work.
Yeah, there's a couple of great ones.
I like what I've seen. Is High Rise the one where, I don't think it is, I think it's a different title. I didn't read it, I heard about it, where there's this sort of upper middle class community complex, And the janitor realizes that they're going mad because everything is okay. Everything is so okay that they're bored. So he starts engineering low-level crimes so that they've got something to bind them together. It's hilarious. The very idea.
That's Cocaine Nights. You know, I mean, he's always very interested in the idea of transgression. You know what I mean? So, you know, he would often have that theme running through his work. For example, in the novel Supercan, which he wrote in at the turn of the millennium in 2000, you know, that's about a group of urban professionals in a kind of business park above the Cannes, you know, above Cannes, where the Cannes Film Festival is. And they're all wealthy, they're all, you know, well-to-do, everything's sort of perfect, but they're bored and they get interested in drugs, they get interested in perverse sexuality, and then they also get interested in attacking migrants. And they go out and form these kind of gangs and they go up and beat up migrants, not for any even political reason, just for fun. You know what I mean? And
that's hilarious. Insane. idea.
And
I approve of that.
No, of course. But the last novel, Kingdom Come, was, you know, set in a kind of mall. And there was a kind of guy who was like a Tom Cruise kind of actor in the UK who represented the mall. And he was very popular. And then he began to hang St. George's flags everywhere. And he begins a kind of fascist movement within the mall. And he becomes like this fascist leader. And he would lead people out from the mall to attack migrants and things. And, you know, it was like this extraordinary kind of right-wing parable. And then it was already written only about 6 years before Trump. So that was his final novel. I think he died around 2010, 2012, around that time. And that was his final novel. It's a masterwork called Kingdom Come, which I would love to make that or Supercan into film. So if there's a very wealthy movie producer out there, give me a call.
All right. I mean, that would be great. I guess from there we could go to, I'd like to know the story of, and I did read this briefly, but I'd like to hear it in your own words, the Melbourne Underground Film Festival.
Sure.
What I'm guessing the acronym was not chosen, it was sort of imposed upon you because it's in contrast to the Melbourne International Film Festival.
Well, yeah, I mean, I made this film, Pearls Before Swine, and I made it in around 1996 with Boyd Rice, Douglas P and a lot of local Australian actors, including someone like Ross Wilson from Daddy Cool, Greg Seeley, David Thrussell from Snog, Max Wearing from another project that Douglas P had done. So anyway, I made this film and I finished it in around 99 after about 3 years of post. It premiered at the Stockholm International Film Festival. Roman Polanski was there on the jury. I met a lot of interesting filmmakers. It played in Sitges in Spain. It played a couple of major, not A-grade festivals, but what you call, top-level B-tier festivals around the world. And I thought, well, I should play it at the Melbourne International Film Festival because I figured it's shot in Melbourne, but they weren't interested in playing it. They thought it was too controversial. Obviously, it's the opposite of politically correct. It's the opposite of that. So when it was rejected, a filmmaker by the name of Philip Brophy tried to mediate to get the film played, but they weren't having it. So then I decided to start my own film festival. And I
Let's go to, but why was it too controversial? Because that's interesting, because this was the end of the 90s. The 90s was the decade where supposedly anything goes. It's constant pressure to get rid of film censorship so that the director's vision could get out there unhampered. There were so many violent films that were, and sexual films that throughout that decade that were always pushing the boundaries there. And indeed, pushing the boundaries was a phrase. You might remember it yourself. It was a thing that people would say with pride. Yeah, we're pushing the boundaries. So what boundary was it that you pushed that was not acceptable?
A film critic at the Stockholm Film Festival said that it was like a low-budget Fight Club. I mean, except, obviously I'd never read the book or seen Fight Club when I made it, because I made it 3 years before. And the book of Fight Club, I don't know when that came out, but I didn't read it when it came out. I only knew about it after the film. It just had a kind of, I guess, a fascist aesthetic, like they thought that Fight Club did. Except, my film had a budget of around 100 grand and, Fight Club had a budget of around 50 million. And the critic at the time sort of compared the two films and, Polanski saw it along with a number of other film critics and, they commented that they had a similar kind of energy. And, I guess Boyd Rice is somebody who, he's somebody who's kind of, he's been connected to a lot of interesting things. He was started in a band called Non, on Mute Records in the late 70s. He was friends with Daniel Miller, the founder of Mute Records, and, you know, who went on to found, you know, he was there when they discovered Depeche Mode, and, you know, he was part of this music scene. But he was part of this magazine called Research out of San Francisco that was like this, you know, counterculture magazine. It was almost like a pre-internet kind of thing, you know, exploring different elements of diverse industrial culture. They did a book on pranks. Boyd was a feature in all these things. But then Boyd's politics, he did an event called 888 with Adam Parfrey from Feral House and a couple other people that, you know, had to do with like the Manson family, kind of like hero worshipping the Manson family. And obviously 8888, you know what that means. And you know what I mean? So, you know, he was somebody who, you know, a bit like Laback, he was dressing up in kind of, you know, kind of fascistic and Nazi-like clothing at concerts. And, you know, he was, you know, but I mean, I think Boyd is somebody who's very politically interesting, but he was certainly doing it to be provocative, you know, first and foremost. And I was just sort of aware of his work. And he was, I think, Answer Me magazine. Jim Goad, you'd know Jim Goad, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, he was part of a number of events that Boyd had done. So there was a nexus of interesting people who were like part of an alternative culture. And Jim Goad, he was in Answer Me magazine, and it had his address. So I just wrote to him and said I had this film about an assassin who, you know, is doing very controversial things, but he's also an author and, you know, who writes kind of like right-wing texts, right-wing rants, etc. And would he like to be involved? And, you know, he was in Australia because Douglas P. from Death in June actually lives in Adelaide over in South Australia. And he was out there in around 1992 or maybe not, maybe it's 93, 94. He was out there recording an album with Douglas P. So I drove over to Adelaide to meet him. We got along. I got along with Douglas P. And I told them both about the film. And they both wanted to be in it. And they both were in it. Kenneth Anger was originally going to be involved at one stage. He, you know, he was a guest at my Hellfire Club. I used to run an event, a nightclub event in Australia, Melbourne and Sydney, called the Hellfire Club. I met Kenneth Anger. He was meant to be in it. When Kenneth Anger dropped out, I was going to get Genesis P. Orridge from Throbbing Gristle. So, you know, I was interested in all these kind of counterculture figures. And, you know, and I guess, you know, for whatever reason, people have, you know, found some of this disturbing. Even though cancel culture wasn't a huge thing, for whatever reason, they weren't going to play it at the Melbourne International Film Festival. Anything that was a bit too, you know, whatever, controversial, they wouldn't play, you know. So I decided to found my own festival and, you know, I released this email saying, you know, I'll accept any film that's been rejected, you know, from the Melbourne International Film Festival. And I got filmmakers like James Wan, who went on to do the Saw movies, the Conjuring movies, you know. He directed Aquaman recently. Patrick Hughes, you know, did a film with Samuel L. Jackson recently, The Hitman's Boyfriend or whatever that's called. A filmmaker called Scott Ryan we discovered at MUFF. He went on to do this fantastic TV show called Mr. In Between. So, you know, a lot of the best filmmakers that have come out of Australia have had their work discovered at my Melbourne Underground Film Festival over the years, which is just, you know, the catalogue floating along the bottom of the line.
Hold on a second. I'll there you go.
There you go. Oh, okay. Okay. You can shorten that. There you go. MUFF, Melbourne Underground. So, yeah, we've been causing trouble for 22 years, and, you know, I enjoy it. I enjoy being the rebel in the industry. I mean, you know, I knew a long time ago that I wasn't going to get government funding for anything, you know. I mean, I made a film called Bloodlust with John Hewitt, another Australian independent filmmaker, when I was 21, about 30 years ago. And, you know, I mean, you know, that was like a vampire gangster film, you know, and of course, you know, the government funding bodies, right? Who wants to see a vampire gangster film? Well, you know, that was 3 or 4 years before From Dusk Till Dawn by Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez. So, you know, and then we wrote a serial killer script together. We took it to the funding bodies, and this was in 1991 or something like this, and they said, who wants to see a serial killer film? And next year, you know, Silence of the Lambs wins the Oscar. So, you know, I mean, we've sort of been trying to do interesting work in Australia, but the funding bodies, you know, don't want it. So I just tend to raise money for films independently. I shoot features for around $100,000. And, you know, I mean, I shot this one on the porn business, for example, in about 10 years ago, in a few different countries. We shot it in the United States, in Thailand, in the UK. And I shot another film at the same time I was doing that called The Second Coming. So, you know, I just am a bit of an independent filmmaker rebel and enjoy flying against the system.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. Would you say that there is less freedom of speech here than there was in the 90s? Or do you think
it's just
the focus has shifted?
Yeah, look, you know, I mean, as I said, I used to run this nightclub called the Hellfire Club, which was a kind of libertarian BDSM club, you know what I mean? Like, it was very popular at the time in Melbourne and Sydney. I mean, you know, you had clubs similar in London, like, I guess, like Submission, Torture Garden, that kind of thing. You know, I went to London at the time. You know, the whole ecstasy thing was big. You know, people were just going to these kind of wild clubs and having a good time. So, you know, I was kind of interested in this kind of thing, and I made a lot of money out of that. So I was kind of lucky to have a successful business in the 1990s that you know, kind of I funded a couple of films, you know, through running nightclubs. And obviously I went back to university and studied philosophy in around 2000 for 4 years. So that kind of funded doing all that. And, you know, I mean, you know, it was just, it was, but at that time there was a great sense of freedom of speech. You could have different politics. People would be okay. Yeah. And also too, things like race and sexuality were very easygoing. You know, we had a lot of gay people who would come to the club. I didn't have a problem with that. Like, you know, but it wasn't like the people who came to the club wanted to teach it in schools. You know what I mean? Like, it was like they just wanted it to be accepted and not be bashed up, which was fine by me. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and it was a similar thing. The racial thing had everyone, you could make racial jokes in front of people. It wasn't that big a deal. You know, it was more actually a form of camaraderie. The way someone like Slazo Zizek says it is, you know,
yeah.
You make a racist joke with somebody who is of a different race, it's actually, you're not insulting them, it's a kind of camaraderie, and they can make a joke about white people, go ahead, you know what I mean? There's plenty to joke about with white people, I tell you. So, you know, I mean, there was a sense of camaraderie, but for whatever reason, the whole culture of political correctness, which I'd always been critical of, because it began to appear in the 90s, but it became hegemonic, I think, in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. You know, and it just seemed to poison everything, and it really began to limit discourse, and, you know, cancel culture became a huge thing. I've been cancelled numerous times, but I had a big one, you know, because I opposed gay marriage, not because I particularly opposed, you know, the marriage, but I believed it would be like a slippery slope where, you know, you would end up, you know, I mean, ridiculous things like teaching, like drag queens would be teaching five-year-olds. I mean, you know, I think things that would never happen.
Well, of course.
You know what I mean? Like, of course.
You know, and they would say that's an outrageous, the slippery slope fallacy and all that, and yet now it's absolutely happening.
That was, so, the children would be like, you know, transgender. I mean, things that obviously would never happen. So, you know, obviously I was completely wrong. So, you know, that was all, you know, as I said, I didn't, the actual issue itself, and I knew some gay people who did want to get married, but I also knew some gay people who weren't interested in getting married, and they thought it was kind of bourgeois and that the gay community shouldn't be embracing this kind of hetero whatever. And it was like, fine, you know what I mean? Like, whatever you think. And I thought there was an argument. I'm very much a natural-born contrarian, so I argued it from that perspective. I got cancelled over that, but, you know, I just keep coming back. And, you know, the more notorious I am, I'm fine with that, because I always think that's what a good artist should do. A good artist should raise questions. A good artist should be provocative. A good artist should, you know, fucking give the establishment the middle finger. And, you know, I do have a little bit of that punk kind of, I mean, though I love electronic music more than punk music, but I do respect that fuck-you-ness of the punk movement and the do-it-yourself-ness of the punk movement, where just get out there and do things. And that's how I've made about, you know, 6 or 7 features over the years, you know, without any government money, you know?
Yeah. Do you ever, I mean, what is the atmosphere like now? You said that you get cancelled a lot now. Mm-hmm. It seems that this is something where, I mean, it's stultifying culture, isn't it?
It is.
I would say it's nothing short of that. It's at this point where if you have the wrong opinion on any issue, you're fucked.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised at the amount of filmmakers. I'm not going to name, you know, many of the ones who come through the Melbourne, but you'd be surprised how many people are sympathetic to, I guess, what you could call the basic positions of the new right, you know, and that many of us have talked about on shows like this. And, you know, I've written essays for, you know, Affirmative Right, you know, Colin Liddell's site that was originally founded by Richard Spencer. I write essays there for a long time. There's about 30 or 40 essays of mine. I think it's called Affirmative Right now. It was called Alternative Right because I changed the name, I think. And,
you know, he fell out with Spencer. So
yeah, that was a great falling out, those two. Anyway, and, so, you know, this craziness. And, you know, I've always been against, you know, like, I don't like the way a lot of people on the right are infighting. I mean, I don't have a problem if people have different opinions to me within the new right, you know, nexus or whatever. Great, you know. I mean, I love people having different opinions. And, you know, I understand sometimes things can get nasty between people. But you know, there's no need for the right to be constantly fighting with itself. Like, there's enough people on the left we can hate. And not everybody on the left is our enemy, too. I mean, you know, there are many people on the old left, you know, who are very suspicious of what you call the globalist cabal, but I guess they would call the 1%. And, you know, they are mistrustful of big corporations. They are mistrustful of Davos. They are mistrustful of the Bilderbergers and people like this. So, you know, I think this is actually the left and right could actually come together, you know, against this kind of, you know, globalist elite.
Exactly. I mean, I don't think I really have any fundamental disagreements with the old left.
Yeah.
I haven't thought about this. It's only just occurred to me now. But as you're talking, I don't really know what I would disagree with them about. Well, maybe hierarchy. I suppose that would be the key thing.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, sure. In terms of practical things, not much.
We can work that stuff out. I mean, there is some difference between what I call the new right and the old left, but we could work out those differences. But we do have the same enemy. And, you know, I had a lot of old left people who were actually quite friendly to me and remain so. I mean, even David Thrussell, who does the No Goat show with me, his background is in the old left. You know, he was originally part of, you know, socialist groups in the 80s and stuff. You know, he used to, you know, many of these people now hate me, but some of them are sympathetic. You know, they're particularly mistrustful of big corporations. It's extraordinary the way the new left today, you know, they worship billionaires like, I don't know, like Bill Gates and...
Well, everyone except Elon Musk.
George Soros, you know, but then I guess on the right, we have our own billionaires that we supposedly love, Donald Trump and Elon Musk. Now, I mean, I think both of those guys are really interesting. And I do think, obviously, there are some millionaires who are legitimately the right wing. It seems like those two are. But, like, you know, I mean, they're not perfect. As we know, Jared Kushner is sort of corrupting Trump, you know, and, you know, Musk has probably similar problems. You know, I mean, you just probably have to talk to Kanye West about that. I wouldn't be an expert on that, but still.
I believe his handler is called Ari Emanuel or something like that.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I would just direct people to statements by Kanye West and say no more on that.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that's been a whole thing, and I don't know if you want to talk about that controversy.
I just think, you know, it's like the elephant in the living room. I mean, you know, if you, for example, you know, we all know there's a problem within the Muslim community, right, in relation to terrorism. And it's not really controversial to talk about that on a show like this, not only on a show like this, but you could go on the ABC or the BBC and talk about, yes, there is a problem with, you know, Muslim terrorism or whatever. And, you know, there are various communities that have problems around the world, but there's a certain community you can't talk about that there is at least a group of people who appear to be up to no good. You know, and I can't see why that isn't a problem, you know, because even if you like that community, you should be able to criticize it if you expect it to get better. And when you can't criticize it, that this becomes ridiculous. And, you know, so I think that's highly unusual and counterproductive, because I've always been somebody who believes you should be able to debate anything, you know.
Yeah. So I thought you said, can you productive there? Not quite.
It's a Freudian slip, maybe. A Freudian slip. Parapraxis.
Yeah. So I guess it seems like a fascinating story about the Underground Film Festival. Is it something that you're finding people are now avoiding as the political correctness ramps up, wokery as it's now called, or are there people still willing to take part in it?
Well, I mean, you know, funnily enough, I mean, you know, there is, you know, there are other underground film festivals around the world. There was the New York Underground Film Festival. That was the oldest one, but that closed about 5 or 10 years ago. So the oldest one in the world is the Chicago Underground Film Festival. And the third oldest is the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. We started in 2000. So if the Chicago one, you know, were to collapse, we would be the longest established underground film festival in the world, which would be nice. So if you know anybody who knows the guy from Chicago Underground Film Festival, one can, you know, but you know what I mean? Like, so, you know, I think that I'm glad that we have, you know, that we embrace, you know, left. So we play stuff from the left. We play stuff from the right and we don't care. I mean, you know, I guess you can tell my politics from looking at the festival, but I don't deliberately try to insert it. This year, I think maybe I have, because in a sense, you know, you're forced into it. And also, too, the mainstream festivals, they all play the lefty, you know, Michael Moore kind of bullshit, you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. They're shamelessly ideological.
Yeah, this year we had a section called Modern Heresies, programmed by David Thrussell. I'll just, you know, I mean, we played My Son Hunter, the film by Robert Davi, that was critical of Hunter Biden. You know, we had 2,000 Mules, that was the Dinesh D'Souza documentary, about the 2020 election being rigged. Obviously, I believe it was rigged. I mean, it's there's no way that an idiot like Joe Biden, who hardly campaigned, got more votes than Barack Obama. It's patently absurd. And obviously, Trump also increased his vote to 74 million. When a president's vote increases, they never lose. So this was another tell that something very dodgy was going on. We played Vaxxed 1 and 2, the two documentaries about the Vax movement, The Great Global Warming Swindle, which was a Channel 4 documentary about, how climate change is a kind of lie about control and making the third world poor. The real Dr. Fauci, a film made by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who should be Democratic Party royalty, which he is, let's face it. But, he's deeply critical of someone like Fauci, deeply critical of the way the Democrats reacted during the COVID crisis. So, we play a lot of this stuff, and I'm very proud of it. I mean, some of these people, like Robert F. Kennedy, come from a left-wing background. I think Michael Gray Griffiths who's pictured here, who I do the show Cafe Lockdown, No Go Show, there, he calls us, the only legitimate underground film festival, because we do play this stuff, we obviously play a lot of other things as well. We play a lot of normal genre movies, low budget films, experimental things as well. But we also play some political stuff that, is off narrative. That's the definition of underground, isn't it? It should be something that's off narrative. If you're doing something, and I don't understand how the modern left can't see that they're just doing the dirty work of people like George Soros, Bill Gates.
They are the establishment now, and I think that's really confusing for them. So they just don't look at it. They just don't think about it.
I mean, the BBC and the ABC and CNN are all on their side. I mean, any true Marxist, that would make them very nervous. I mean, Karl Marx would say, "What's going on?" I mean, the people in power are behind you. You must be wrong. I mean? Like, this is Marxism 101. I mean, I practically got to explain to people on the new left what Marx means, because it's clearly they haven't read him. You know what I mean?
No, of course not.
I'm not a fan of Marx's solutions, but some of his critiques, and obviously even someone like Chomsky, I've often found some of his critiques of capitalism very interesting.
Yes.
His solution, which is a kind of nutty, kind of left wing. What's the word? It's collectivism. Where everyone owns the means of production. That's never going to work, because I do think we need hierarchies, and I guess that makes me somebody of the new right. Our ideas on hierarchy.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask a question. I've just realized it's maybe not a great idea, but what would you say about the other underground film festivals? Do you know much about the Chicago one, for example? And obviously,
the Chicago would play the work of, more traditional, people, they would play someone like Kenneth Anger. They would play, a lot of the kind of experimental, works from the 60s and 70s that are traditionally considered underground. John Waters, people like this. I mean, I like all these filmmakers. I've played their work at my film festival as well. But it's like, I wanted to go off into some different areas. But they wouldn't touch anything that had anything to do with the new right, or that was anything that could be considered pro-Trump or pro-Putin, or Like, they would just have a heart attack if they went near any of that. There's a film festival called the Sydney Underground Film Festival. The filmmaker Stefan Popescu came down to Muff, and I was talking about starting, because I used to run the Hellfire Club in Melbourne and Sydney. I thought I'd start a film festival up in Sydney, and I wanted to call it the Sydney Newtown Underground Film Festival, or Snuff, because I thought Muff and Snuff is kind of funny, right? And sex and death, etc. And he was like, "Yeah, I'm interested in maybe doing that." And so he went up and he registered the name, and he sent me the certificate. But then he rang me and said, "Oh, I'm not doing the Sydney, that with you. You can do it, but I'm going to do the Sydney Underground Film Festival." So he set up that and decided to do it on his own. And it was all politically correct. It's everything in it is exactly, like I said, what's traditionally considered the underground. Plus, he'll play some alternative works that are about a groovy band from the punk era, this kind of thing. But he won't play anything that's politically confrontational or could be considered of the new right. I don't know why. I guess that's his decision. He and his partner Catherine run that festival, and good luck to them. They played one of my films when they first started, so that was nice enough, I suppose. But I always thought they ripped me off, which is exactly what they did do, by the way.
Okay. I just wondered if you were, that was the matter I was getting to, was is your festival more open to controversial, like genuinely controversial stuff than
absolutely. I'll play anything. You know, we played a David Irving, you know, like the thing on David Irving.
Oh, yes. Yes, I heard
local, about that. You know, Jewish community over that, you know, they took me to court and, you know, I got a lawyer and a QC who are friends of mine, and, you know, they defended, you know, our right to play such a documentary. And so, you know, that went ahead, you know, and, so we had one of the few victories anywhere in the world on that particular topic. You know, but I've done things, I guess, where I would defend the rights of filmmakers who would be considered of the left. You know, for example, a film called L.A. Zombie by a gay Canadian director called Bruce LaBruce. You know, we defended that. I mean, that was banned from the Melbourne International Film Festival because it was gay sex and like zombies. I mean, not really, obviously. There's actors, you know, playing zombies and having gay sex. And I thought there's no reason this film should be banned. So I did a kind of a legal screening of it. I said, you've got to join this group on Facebook and then we'll secretly reveal the venue. I got arrested for that and taken to court. And, you know, so, I mean, I could have gone to jail. I could have got a couple of months in jail. I mean, obviously, I only got a $1,000 fine, which I had to donate to the Royal Children's Hospital, which I had no problem with. And, but, you know, I didn't get any kind of criminal conviction. You know, the judge seemed to be understanding that I was defending freedom of speech. So, you know, I mean, this is why when I was accused of being homophobic over my, you know, I said it's ridiculous because obviously I've defended gay filmmakers. I've run the Hellfire Club. At least a quarter of the audience was gay and they would come every week. And I was always very friendly with these kind of people and, you know, got along with them and, you know. Even though I guess the Hellfire Club was mainly a straight club and, you know, I guess, you know, we do have some gay films at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. We don't not play films we play everything, you know, that's interesting. And from having that kind of curatorial perspective, we've discovered a lot of the most interesting work. And we can also, you know, just, you know, raise issues and, you know, try and be contentious and, you know, we've done lots of things over the years that have upset people and that's why we do it. I enjoy upsetting people.
I got that feeling. you seem to have that right. Mischievous character.
I did it with the Hellfire Club too. You know, we had a dress up as a Nazi theme night that caused trouble. Obviously, we had a pro GJ Ballard night where we kind of celebrated like car accidents. You know, that we got on the front page of the Herald Sun with that. You know, make it out which we're encouraging drink driving or something. You know. So, you know, it's just, but, you know, I sort of I have a bit of a Malcolm McLaren, you know, I know the buttons to push that'll get you on the front page of the newspaper. And occasionally I've pushed them because, you know, I mean, when you're running an independent event, you know, you want free publicity, basically, and upsetting people is the easy way to do it, you know. So I totally, hats off to Malcolm McLaren for his, that's, you know, I mean, he was a bit of a rogue, a lovable rogue, and maybe I am as well, so.
Yes. Well, the final question I would ask you about is, and we've kind of touched on it a wee bit, is COVID. So
yeah,
this has been a theme on Millennial for the last 2 years, and it's definitely there still as a thing because it's, you know, the pandemic is over, but it remains with us in terms of the effects it's had.
Yeah,
and as you were saying, the actual condition, the virus is still out there. Supposedly, so that's no, it's fine. Don't worry. it's an interesting issue. So, what would you say about COVID retrospectively and now?
Well, I mean, we've lived through 2.5 year. I mean, psyop like nothing I've ever seen. I mean, it was a clear attack upon human liberty. It was a clear attack upon on people in Western civilization. I mean, that's what COVID was to me. It had nothing to do with the actual disease, which, as far as I was concerned, was nothing. Obviously, you want to protect your grandmother maybe from it, but I mean, I think maybe only people over 80 really had a real worry with this disease. Everybody else went about their normal life. We see that a country like Sweden didn't lock down, and the Republican-run state of Florida didn't lock down, and you know their economies didn't suffer. I mean, you know, the economic damage. Melbourne, where I live. And it was one of the longest lockdowns in the world. Actually, it was the longest. And that was, you know, and they just re-elected the dictator. His name's Dan Andrews. He's like our local, he's like the premier, which is like the, I guess, the leader of the state. He's like, you know, he's a bit like DeSantis, but like the evil DeSantis. So, you know, he locked us down for the longest time in the world, even longer than people in China and people in, like, South America, you know. So it's extraordinary. To me, I mean, you know, the whole thing was deeply suspicious. The way they did that Agenda 21, which was like an event where they did a kind of Johns Hopkins University.
That yeah, was like it was that Event 201, I think you're thinking of.
Where they were like, you know, they did like a dry run, you know, where they pretended there was a global pandemic. And then a month later, the real one was released. I mean, you know, really, couldn't they have done it a couple of years before so it doesn't look so obvious? You know, that guy, Carrie Mullins, you know, who invented the PCR test, you know, he died mysteriously just before this started. You know, the way it was leaked, you know, there was all that story that came from a bat, but clearly it came from that bioweapons lab. And then you see that Dr. Fauci has links to it, that, you know, numerous globalists had visited this place. So the whole thing looks like a globalist operation from start to finish. And the most disturbing thing is they wanted to, you know, force inject a lot of people in Western civilization with this vaccine. I mean, these are people who are notorious depopulationists. These are people who are notorious misanthropes who hate humanity on a gigantic scale that probably makes the communists and the Nazis look like school children. And, you know, here they've gone and injected half the planet with this God knows what. And then, you know, you see now there's like died suddenly. We played that documentary this year at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. People are just dropping dead all over. And not, you know, not obviously not so much from the anti-vax movement. They're not dying. It's everybody who took it. And, you know, sports stars, celebrities, they're just dropping like flies. And it's like, you know, and it's not like they're in their 80s too. They're like, some of them are in their 20s or so. And there's a compilation that's on BitChute or whatever of sports stars just healing over in the field. And then someone like Djokovic, who didn't take it, is like mocked and attacked and banned from attending, you know, Grand Slam events. And clearly, I mean, what kind of threat does COVID have to a sports star in that peak physical condition? I mean, he would laugh off COVID. He wouldn't even get a
absolutely
runny nose.
Absolutely.
So he's very right not to take that vaccine. And obviously, if it could possibly limit him physically, you know, if it could have some side effect that maybe affected his heart, like myocarditis, or, you know, I mean, God, you know, why would you take it? And, you know, but it seems many people got pressured into it. They bought the mainstream line. You know, to me, the vaccine was some kind of accelerant, you know, that if there's something wrong with you, it accelerates it. Or in some people's cases, it creates heart problems, you know, myocarditis. And you see these kind of...
It seems to be blood clots.
Blocks, she's, you know, I mean, if you have a blood clot and that gets anywhere near your heart, it's, you know, it's goodbye Irene, you know? So, I mean, I don't know why anyone would want to go near that bullshit, you know, but it's not like I've always been anti-vax. I made a documentary in Uganda in 2009 with a local filmmaker, Ebony Butler. We went to northern Uganda for 6 weeks. I took about five or six vaccines before doing that because I looked at them and, you know, there was a certain danger. And the doctor gave you a list of things and said, you know, these are the dangers, you know, and there were some. But you looked at that in relation to, say, hepatitis or some of the things that are quite rampant in northern Uganda, and you thought, oh, I'll risk it. You know, so I took those and I've never had any trouble. But, you know, the way this was rushed, I mean, how could they get a vaccine, you know, ready within a year? You know, that thing would have been ready, you know, before the event even started. You know, it's just it's all very mysterious. What are your thoughts?
Well, I agree with you. I agree with everything you said. And I'm not anti-vax either. You know, of course, you know, in the old days, it was a completely different situation, though, because that was before everything got corrupted, or at least as far as we know. You know, if you got a vaccine 10 years ago against something, you know, whatever. But the COVID vaccine, well, first of all, it's not actually a vaccine. But no. Second, even if it were a vaccine, it was clearly at best rushed through.
Yep.
And more likely, as you say, it was already there. And it doesn't work like a normal vaccine. This is the key thing, really.
RNA.
mRNA.
AstraZeneca, from my own research, AstraZeneca seems slightly safer. I mean, I know some family members who took that who've had no trouble. You know, I know some people who've had the Pfizer and who have had trouble. But, I mean, I also know people who've had the Pfizer and there's been no trouble. So, you know, I don't think everybody got the hot shot. You know what I mean? They couldn't, you know. So I think a lot of people were given saline. You know what I mean? We're just given water, you know, lolly water. And, you know, they're going to be fine, obviously. But I think some people were given something a bit strange. And, you know, obviously it will probably depend on the individual too. Some people could shrug it off. You know what I mean? And other people, you know, won't be able to shrug it off. And, you know, some have already joined the heavenly choir.
Yeah, indeed. A surprising number, and it died suddenly, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And also there are people who have, they've not died, but they've, you know, they've had serious side effects.
Serious.
Yeah. I mean, some of the stuff is horrendous.
This show, Cafe Lockdown, you know, that I do with Michael Gray Griffiths, which is a really great show if you're into the whole freedom movement, anti-vax, and we do a show on Sunday night called The No Goat Show there. So, you know, that's kind of fun. You know, the goat, whenever we would, the goat was kind of represented censorship, you know. Whenever I would go too far or somebody on the show would go too far, they would put up this picture of a goat to kind of block them out. And I said, why don't we do a show where we have no goat? That's like the no censorship show. So that became the No Goat Show. And then we do it Sunday nights on Cafe Lockdown. It's myself, Michael Greg Griffiths, David Thrussell from the band Snog, and we're joined by different people. Damien Richardson, the local actor who's an, you know, freedom movement candidate. He ran for parliament federally in Australia and also in the state election recently. Ryan Etherington, who's a comedian. You know, he does funny send-ups of Daniel Andrews and interesting jokes. And we get lots of interesting people who've been on the show. You know, we had did a show with Julian Assange's father, you know, which was very popular. We sold that out in Melbourne. We had Julian Assange's dad on. You know, he's somebody, obviously, we admire Julian Assange and support his, you know, we want his release from a UK jail. What the hell is that all about? You know, it's ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I was really disappointed that Trump didn't pardon him.
Yeah, I think he's blackmailed over the whole January 6th thing. You know what I mean? Like, they were like, we're going to impeach you or the Republican Party. Because the Republican Party is corrupt. I mean, you know, the way that the Democrat Party is. You know, I mean, this is why, I mean, people like Mitch McConnell and, you know, all those rhino kind of Republicans, they're just getting, they're either blackmailed like with Pizzagate kind of stuff or they're bought. You know, they're just so deep in corruption they can never escape. And, you know, so that's why the Republican Party, you know, turned on Trump. And, you know, obviously they wanted him gone. But the reason they wanted him gone, which is always why I like Trump, because for whatever reason, even with Kushner, they're corrupting him and making him let Israel do whatever the hell they like. There was still something in Trump that was a threat to the globalists. And whatever that was is good. And I'll be happy if it returned because he was some kind of wild cannon. For whatever reason, he wasn't fully under control. And, you know, probably like Kanye, right? So, you know, for whatever reason, he was great because of the way they hate him. And that's the similar thing with Putin. Clearly, they hate Putin so much, which is why, you know, there must be something good about Putin. You know, obviously, I've been interested in Alexander Dugin. You know, he's a friend of mine on Facebook. He shared a couple of my essays that were at Affirmative Right. You know, he's a nice guy. Obviously, it was terrible what happened to his daughter recently. You know, that was a terrible event, I thought. You know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think you're right about Trump. It's not like he's our guy or whatever. No, but he's not perfect. But they definitely don't feel that he's their guy either. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's it's absolutely genuine. You know, the hatred of him is real. It's visceral.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why we like him, you know, because he upsets them so much that you know, that alone is good enough for me. You know what I mean? Anybody politically who upsets the globalist class that much has got to be fantastic, even if he isn't perfect. And obviously Trump wasn't perfect. There's parts of Trump that we don't like. I mean, you know, but like, I still think he's fun. You know, his son, Don Jr., seems fun. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, when you look at Biden's son, Jesus Christ, I mean, Hunter Biden, I mean, you know.
He's a complete wreck. Oh, my God.
I feel sorry for the guy.
Yeah, well, I don't know. No, I don't. I think
he's paid Cody a run for his money.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's just crazy. You know, it's like the corruption there with Hunter Biden. It's just, it's like he's completely shameless about it. It's like he wants to be found out. This is what's so funny about it. But at the same time, it's deadly serious because this is like the top of society, or at least the top of visible society.
You see many of these people who do things that are so stupid that it almost reveals them. Maybe they do want to be discovered. You know what I mean? Like at a subconscious level, at least. Maybe Hunter Biden does want to blow the lid off this stuff. Like because he's had to be basically, you know, it's obvious what he was in the Ukraine. He was the bag man. He was in some Ukrainian energy company collecting the pay kickback money from all the money sent to Ukraine, and there'd be another one there now. You know what I mean? Like this is how it works. They pour billions in, and then there are kickbacks. Probably hundreds of millions of dollars are being kicked back. You know, for the big guy, it was all there, and obviously he's compromised in China. He's compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, I don't know how the American military put up with this, that basically the President of the United States is compromised by the Chinese Communist Party and by Russia and by Ukraine. You know, I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous. You, I mean, you know, obviously the American military has been corrupted. You see the leaders, one of the Levine dressing up as a woman, and there's a, you know, there's other ones like you dressed up as a dog recently, and the other one who was stealing luggage, who's like a bald guy with a bald woman with a moustache. I mean, you know, these are the leaders of the American military. I mean, if they were to show that to the people who invaded on D-Day, they would have turned around, right? So that's it. You know, sorry, Uncle Adolf.
I know they wouldn't believe how far their country had fallen,
it has fallen, and it's terrible, terrible. Yeah. You know, and you know, Western civilization is under direct threat. I mean, people ask my politics. I'm pro Western civilization, but I'm pro West what Western civilization used to be. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I think that you know, European Western civilization has been a great civilizational influence on all of humanity, and that you know, overall, the standard of living of the whole world has been raised by us. And also, you know, freedom exists within some Western countries still to this day, but it doesn't really exist in many third world countries. I'm a pretty well-traveled guy. And obviously, for a tourist, you go to somewhere like Thailand or Bali, you know, I mean, there's a certain level of great freedom in these countries, particularly if you're a tourist. But you see the terrible poverty that the people are in these countries. I've been to Africa, the terrible poverty. And these countries have vast resources. But the governments are just run by gangsters. Like, you know, things were better run, for example, when I went to Uganda, and the Ugandans told me this. They said, things were better run by the English, because they said the English would maybe pay you half a wage from the UK. But that was a lot of money for Uganda. Now everyone gets paid nothing. And the gangsters who run things, like Museveni in Uganda, I mean, these are just, they work for the globalists, and they steal the diamonds, they steal the oil. China is in Africa at the moment in a huge way. There's another, you know, grab for China. I think Western powers and China are like, you know, jostling for position. I mean, you know, there's a reason there's no Wakanda in Africa. You know, it's because they've never been able to allow to develop their own resources. You know, I mean, why is there not a city like Singapore? I mean, outside of maybe Johannesburg, which is obviously a Western city, you know, at least was until recently. You know? So it's just, it's terrible. I think, you know, European civilization is the great liberator of the whole planet and would free the whole planet if it was allowed to finish its mission, the mission that it was sent to do by God. But, you know, obviously the globalists are interested, you know, who work for the devil, are there to, you know, destroy this and destroy, you know, the whole of humanity and to infect the planet with the Antichrist spirit. So that's my summary.
Oh, yeah, it's an interesting summary right at the end there. That's great. You know, I mean, I'm not religious, and yet you look at this stuff and you think, well, I don't know if God exists, but I'm pretty damn sure that evil exists as a force in the world, you know?
Tell you a story.
How else can this all be happening?
I can tell you a story from running the Hellfire Club. You know, I mean, I was somebody, I went to, you know, a local boys' school called Ivanhoe Grammar. We had to go to church every, you know, like Friday and sit in Church of England. It was very boring. It was like something from a Monty Python movie, you know, so someone is, you know, whatever, you know, gone near the cormorant or whatever, you know, terrible, boring, oppressive, etc. So I had a bit of a reaction against religion as a teenager. And so, you know, when I ran the Hellfire Club, it was, again, a kind of rebellion thing. And I got sort of interested in occult literature. I read some Crowley and I read, you know, Anton LaVey and a few different people like this and that. But, you know, but I actually met a few people who are what I would consider serious black magicians. And I found them quite scary, to be honest. And, you know, I saw a few of them, you know, and were involved in things that were quite real. So, you know, from doing the Hellfire Club, I saw the dark side of things, so to speak. And that kind of scared me back to, I guess, a more Christian position. I was also interested in the philosopher Martin Heidegger and Nietzsche, so I do understand the kind of more existentialist, you know, atheist perspective. But there does seem to be something else going on, and I definitely know it's true in relation to the dark arts. And that kind of also made me think, well, if the dark arts are real, well, sort of Christianity is. And that is how I came back to the church, I guess, you know, so from that way. Though I don't go to church every Sunday or anything. I'm somebody who's just always interested in, you know, metaphysical ideas and theology. You know, I have a huge library. I've got about 40 bookshelves of books and movies in this house. And, you know, I've always studied this stuff because I found it interesting, you know. So that's my little story about theology.
Excellent. Interesting. Well, okay, I'm aware of the time pressure. So we'll just get to the two questions have been posted. Chain Reaction gives a donation and says, just because everyone has a buck, thank you very much. Some Random Bloke says, I am from Melbourne, Australia. Unfortunately, I didn't attend the Muff Festival this year. Does Richard have any other festivals or movie screenings besides the annual events?
Well, we do the No Goat shows. We've been doing these No Goat shows. I held up the T-shirt a couple of times. So if you join Cafe Locked Out and the No Goat show there and watch that every Sunday night, that's where we will announce any new shows we're doing. We did the last one at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival about 10 days ago. So hopefully we'll be doing another one of those. Probably, you know, we'll probably have a break over Christmas. So it'll probably be, you know, late January around Australia Day is probably when we'll think of doing something again. Obviously I'll be doing the call for entries for the next Melbourne Underground Film Festival. That'll start in January. Also too, if you want to look at my political podcasts, join a thing called The Unshackled. It's on Facebook, it's on, you know, YouTube, and my report from Tiger Mountain, which is obviously a send up of that report from Iron Mountain and mixed with a bit of Julia Savola. So the report from Tiger Mountain is my little podcast that I do. It's just me talking about politics and ideas for about 5 or 10 minutes. I try and keep them short and punchy. And, you know, some of those have gone viral. You know, I did one on Jerry Nadler shitting himself, which got like, you know, like 100,000 views or whatever. It must have been shared by Donald Trump or somebody because it just went absolutely everywhere. So it was very funny. And so a few of those have just gone very viral. And look, I'd just like to say it's a real pleasure to talk to you, Millennial Woes, Colin, because, you know, I've heard a lot about you from, you know, I guess from the circle of the new right, the alt-right, the dissident right, whatever you want to call it, all this thing. And, you know, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. You seem like a very smart fellow, and hats off to you for all the great work you've done over the years.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and the same to you. It's a fascinating story. So, I wish you luck with all of this stuff. Excellent. Well, I should say, by the way, I'm sorry that I didn't answer the questions with the previous stream, but time was of the essence at that moment, so I do apologise about those super chats. All right. Well, thank you very much. This has been a really interesting conversation, so I'm glad, and it was arranged hastily, so...
Yep.
Yeah, all the more grateful. Well,
let's chat again, mate. It's great. You know, you seem like a top bloke. And, you know, I'd like to shout out to all the other guests on Millennial. John Morgan is one. I think you had him on, or you are having him on. You know, he's somebody who's a friend of mine on Facebook. He's fantastic. You know, always been very erudite. Obviously used to work for Arctos and stuff. So, you know, shout out to all the gang at the Millennial program.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, excellent. Well, I'll be back tomorrow night. Let me see what the schedule is for that. I forget from one day to the next. Survive the Jive, then Scott Mannion, then Vico Hesler, and then Robin Riley. So that will be a very interesting lineup. In the meantime, Richard Wollstonecroft, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Thank you, Millennial Wise Colin. It's been fantastic, mate. And, you know, Merry Christmas, and a Merry Christmas to all the gang.
Okay, right. Merry Christmas to you too. Yes. All right, everyone, I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time. Enjoy the show and spread the word.